People's Tribune Radio is on the air. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. On this edition of People's Tribune Radio, we honor African American History Month with our guest, William Watkins, author of the book, The White Architects of Black Education.
But nevertheless, it gets back to the idea of controlling ideas, because now with mandatory testing, the curriculum can only be centered on a narrow body of knowledge rather than a wide body of inquiry. And I promise you that in that narrow body of knowledge, there's very little, again, social investigation, political inquiry. There's no sense of the child learning about the world around him. So in fact, the education that's being proposed is much more miseducation than it is education, and it's creating a narrowing of the imagination.
People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also published the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. February is African American History Month, and other than the struggle for freedom itself, there has been perhaps no greater struggle for blacks in America than the struggle for education. William Watkins is the author of The White Architects of Black Education. He was interviewed by Sheila Garland Olaniram in Chicago, Illinois.
With us today for a discussion is Professor William H. Watkins, author of the recently released book, The White Architects of Black Education. You have a long history as an educator, not only as a public school teacher, but as a professor at the University of Utah and the University of Illinois at Chicago.
My book is really, I believe, a look at how ideas are sponsored, how ideas are used to create conformity, consensus among the population, how the power group, the ruling group in our country, spread the ideas that they wish to have govern our society. Because ideas don't just fall from the sky. They just don't come from anywhere. They come from conscious elements who try to promote them among people.
In your book, you focus on the developing and institutionalizing of certain ideas. You talk about the impact of the development of these ideas in the notion of education, or at least how education came to be.
Well, specifically, I chose the term architect because of the implications. Let's face it, we have had in America colonial education. Very clearly, it was intended that people of color occupy a certain position in the industrial capitalist society. And that position would be as beasts of burden, as agricultural laborers, as semi-skilled laborers, as strike breakers, all of the lower strata of our society. And the educational system was structured to carry out a political agenda. So there was a different kind of education for African Americans than there was for the traditional public school. And I became interested in what was that, as Henry Bullock called it, that special kind of education that was concocted for people of color. And so the architects tries to draw our attention to this group of people who actually conspired. Black education is not a result of any accident. It didn't just happen by happenstance. There was a conspiracy. There were conferences that were held in different parts of the country where no African American educators were invited to participate, where the curriculum was actually mapped out. A curriculum for subservience, a curriculum for racial inferiority, a curriculum that would create a certain kind of population that could, at some minimal level, be invested in America, but at the same time remain subservient labor, remain inferior both politically and socially. So these architects that I have tried to explore were powerful people, and many of them are names that you would recognize, such as the Rockefeller family. Others are names that you would not recognize, but people that nevertheless played an important role behind the scenes in developing an educational program, which was really a political program. I think the important thing that I want to get over about black education is that it wasn't really about education at all. It was about situating a group of people for the 20th century.
In the book, you do talk at length about scientific racism and the development of scientific racism.
Racism has been with us for a while. In the mid to late 19th century, the scientific and medical community, as well as the political establishment, got very much involved in trying to make racism more officious and make it more, in their terms, scientific. That is, using measurement, using the appeal to numbers, which was very much a part of our intellectual society at that time. So the concept of measuring skulls, measuring all sorts of body parts, became an integral part of scientific racism in an effort to so-called prove the inferiority of people of color. Later on, around the time of World War I, IQ testing, the standardized test, then became the central vehicle of scientific racism. And those standardized tests were, in effect, said to be the proof that people of color were inferior because they, across the board, they were scoring lower. Well, of course they were going to score lower. They had not been exposed to education. How are you going to take a group of people that were enslaved for 350-odd years and simply say, well, now you're going to be equal to free people? So that whole testing movement, which I hope we'll return to a little bit later on, is an outgrowth of scientific racism, which is still with us today. The testing movement has now become thoroughly institutionalized in public education. There's not a school district in the country that does not use standardized testing. In fact, our Congress made it mandatory that every state in the union must, in some way or another, impose standardized tests. All this is an outgrowth of the movement of scientific racism. And in the final analysis, testing and the other tools that our educational establishment uses are simply another way to try to justify inequality. And every system based on economic inequality has to find ways and means of justifying why some people have more resources than others, why some people have more power than others, why some people have more freedom than others. That has to be justified. And school and testing have been ideal ways of trying to make inequality understandable. Of course, it's all a fraud, and we know it's a fraud, but it's perpetrated against us nevertheless.
Many parents and the general population have been swept up into this notion of testing, and parents are struggling and confused about the crisis in education, and all of these, or at least as far as we can see, the crisis that has developed or that continues to develop in education clearly is an offshoot of the development of the ideas of these architects that you research.
The public schools are not failing in terms of what they were intended to do. They're doing exactly what they were assigned to do, and that is to continue to reproduce the existing relationships that we have in our society, the existing authority structures, the existing power relationships. The silencing of children is no different than the silencing of working people in a major corporation. So the schools are training people to continue and to perpetuate the existing relationships. And the reward systems in school are very similar to the reward systems in the larger society. So in that sense, in the sense of why public schools were established in America, they're not failing at all. However, they're failing miserably when it comes to inner city children, children of color, children of working people, children of poverty. They're failing miserably because the schools have not committed their resources to educate everyone. Jonathan Kozol's fine book entitled Savage Inequalities gives us a real clear and illustrative example of the maldistribution of power and resources in schools. And there's a direct correlation between resources and achievement. We know a lot about educating children. We know a lot about how to proceed from children's own experiences, which we don't do in school. We do a lot of imposed learning. We do a lot of drill and kill. We do a lot of things that are totally irrelevant to children. We force them to memorize timetables. We force them to diagram sentences. We force them to do things that they'll never, ever be called upon to do in life. So in part, the educational system is structured so that some will fail, that others might succeed. So once again, we're continuing the inequality. What can parents do? Parents can demand, number one, that political changes take place in education. It's utterly ridiculous that some school districts in the North Shore spend many thousands of dollars per capita a year on their students, and some of the schools south of Roosevelt Road have maybe $750 a year per capita. The inequalities are both glaring and absurd and unacceptable. So we have to find a way, number one, to equalize resources. We have to find a way to make the curriculum much more relevant to young people who proceed from their world, not from some world of core curriculum guides brought in from some downtown bureaucrat. We need to bring social inquiry into our educational system so that our students learn about the world around them rather than a barrage of unconnected and useless facts. The things that are really important in education, that is, interrogating our society, interrogating the power relationships in our society, investigating. John Dewey talked about trying to create democracy. Those kinds of things are not happening. Since we've been talking about testing a little bit, we should be aware that our children are the most tested of any children on the planet Earth. The schools have been turned into gigantic pressure cookers for testing. And so the interesting part of education has all been overwhelmed by teaching to the test, because all of the new state mandates now reward school districts based on achievement. And so school districts have benchmarks that they're forced to try to meet. And if they don't meet these benchmarks, there are punitive measures. I mean, for the first time, we're seeing now the imposition of punitive measures as a result of poor achievement scores in Chicago. Certainly, schools have been put on probation. Some schools have been even threatened with the death penalty. So we have quite a whole complex political issue and problem connected with our public schools. The parents aren't demanding these tests. The teachers aren't demanding tests. Certainly the students are not demanding standardized tests. It's only the political bureaucrats that are imposing testing in our schools. It's probably the worst thing we could do. We have all sorts of other alternative ways of measuring kids' achievement, and we know how to do that.
What is the role of poverty and increasing poverty, increasing joblessness? We see all of these factors, and I know that Jonathan Kozol has written about it in many of his books, and we see it every day, and I'm sure you as an educator have seen that. What is the impact of that on children's ability to receive an education, and the way that you've described how the system of education has been set up and what its purposes are? How does that play into that?
One way has to do with how children see their future. What do little black and brown children see their life's work? What do they see as their chances in life? And how does education relate to that? What is their commitment to education given our society? We now know that something like, one in four or five children is now born into poverty across the United States. And in the third world, it's, probably 8 or 9 out of 10 children. And what does it mean for children that don't have any resources, that don't have any support, that perhaps don't even eat properly? What are the implications, again, for learning? And what are the implications of learning for change in our society? An educated population can be dangerous. And I think our powers that be, our ruling elite, understand the limits of education, at least the limits that they want to impose, because an educated population can raise questions. An educated population can begin to organize. Whoever it was that said, the pen is mightier than the sword, knew exactly what they were talking about. Because ideas are very, very powerful things. So there's a tightening going on within education. There is much more control of the curriculum. There's much more idea management. There's much more what we in the field call teacher-proofing the curriculum, where they don't want to leave anything to the teacher's discretion. The curriculum has narrowed to the point where its intention is to create conforming, obedient citizens that do not challenge the social order, do not challenge the economic order, do not challenge the world order. And let's face it, in this globalized and globalizing economy where many people are being left out, where we're going to see some unspeakable poverty that we've never seen before. And I thought we'd seen the worst of poverty, but this new poverty that we're seeing, this kind of absolute poverty, is going to be a result of the new globalized society. So education has all sorts of political, philosophical, and social implications in the world order.
This is Sheila Olani-Ron with People's Tribune Radio. We're here in Chicago speaking with Professor William H. Watkins, talking about his research and his recently released book, The White Architects of Black Education. Since September the 11th, a lot of what's important domestically has been set aside, or at least it doesn't come glaring into the headlines. But the Bush administration is proceeding with their plan for educational reform. And they've made, as you said, punitive components to whether schools are meeting certain benchmarks. What will that mean for our children? And I know that we've been talking about it from the perspective of black and brown children, but I think that this educational reform impacts all children, black, white, and everything in between.
The Bush agenda can be found in a document entitled No Child Left Behind. Those of you that have access to a computer, you can get it right off the internet. It's about a 30 or 40 page document which lays out exactly what the George Bush agenda is all about, which is the agenda of the ruling elite at this point. And once again, it brings the federal government to bear in business that was formerly supervised by the state, and that is education, achievement, measurement, testing, et cetera, et cetera. As I mentioned, the Bush program calls for increased standardized testing. It calls for mandatory testing. It calls for alternatives where it's very interesting how the document is worded, because it calls for failing students to have alternatives. This is kind of a new twist on schools for choice, as the Bush administration has not been real successful in the choice movement. especially after the state of Michigan turned down, voted down choice. They sort of backed off of some of that language, and now they're just talking about alternatives, making it appear that if a child doesn't do well in one school, he can go somewhere else. Well, that's really a smokescreen for the newly established ability to punish schools. I mean, where are children going to go if they're not doing well in their neighborhood school? What are you going to do, send them across town? The presumption being that they're going to do better over there? Or are you going to send them to a private school? I mean, it's all very absurd, and it's all very confused and convoluted. But nevertheless, it gets back to the idea of controlling ideas, because now with mandatory testing, the curriculum can only be centered on a narrow body of knowledge rather than a wide body of inquiry. And I promise you that in that narrow body of knowledge, there's very little, again, social investigation, political inquiry. There's no sense of the child learning about the world around him, but rather learning facts to be regurgitated, names and dates, the great presidents, the great military leaders, et cetera, et cetera. So, in fact, the education that's being proposed is much more miseducation than it is education, and it's creating a narrowing of the imagination. I mean, one of the things we want education to do is speak to the imagination of children and their natural interest. We don't have to make children want to learn. Children are natural learners, and they want to know about the world around them, and they want to know it in the way they can understand it. So we want them to have experiential knowledge. Everything that's being talked about in the Bush agenda takes us away from that. Once again, the Bush agenda calls for making funds available to schools that meet their benchmarks and somehow threatening funds to those that don't. And I should add that all of this, all of the Bush program is presented in a context of hysteria. And this is the kind of hysteria that began back in the 1950s with the Sputnik movement. And the hysteria from the educators and politicians said, oh my God, the Russians are going to leave us behind. The country's going to fall apart. And then after the Russians, and it was the Japanese. And then if you read the reform documents of the 80s, it was, oh my God, the Japanese are going to leave us behind. It's very interesting. If you read the introduction to No Child Left Behind, they talk about how Cyprus has passed up the United States. So I guess Cyprus is the new political threat. I didn't know how to figure that. But anyway, a lot of this stuff is just based in hysteria. It's based in foolishness. I mean, at the same time, they're talking about the country falling apart and falling behind. We had 10 years of the unprecedented and uninterrupted prosperity. So it's absolutely ridiculous to construct an argument that the schools have been leading the way to social decline, social erosion, and economic collapse.
Is there a solution to the crisis in education? And can this crisis be solved separate from the general crisis facing all of our social institutions?
Well, that's a most interesting question. And our schools have become hotbeds of struggle. Parents are demanding change. Teachers are demanding change. I don't want to discourage those people who are in the trenches fighting for a better education, because that fight must continue. At the same time, we need to understand that our schools are very much connected with the larger economic, political, and social structure. Schools are part of the arrangements of power in America. And schools are not going to change the way we'd like them to until our society changes to much more of a cooperative, collectivistic society. Because as long as inequality is the watchword of our economy, then inequality is going to be the watchword of what we try to teach, because schools have to represent and mirror the larger society. So the struggle for better schools is very much connected to the struggle for more participation, for more equality in our society, for more the opportunity for people to have a decent life and to enjoy the bounty of our world. There's certainly plenty of resources. There's enough to go around. We just got to figure out a way to spread them around.
William Watkins is the author of The White Architects of Black Education. He was interviewed by Sheila Olanaran in Chicago, Illinois. The following is a commentary from the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. While we oppose terrorism in all its forms, we should recognize that we will not have peace in the world until we put an end to the poverty and hopelessness that is the ultimate source of the violence. In New York, 38,000 families will lose their right to welfare. With unemployment on the rise and little government aid, how can families possibly continue to live? David R. Jones, chief executive of the Community Service Society, alerts us that it is like two freight trains on the same track, people coming off the welfare rolls and people being laid off because of the depth of the recession. As the war continues, billions of tax dollars are being depleted rather than it being spent to secure the livelihood of all of those being affected by our downtrodden economy. The truth of the matter is that the U.S. economy had been hurting for some time. It started with layoffs in the industrial South and Midwest in the steel, auto, and textile industries, preceding the layoffs in the nation's information computer and telecommunications industries. The September 11th attacks only worsened the situation. The war against terrorism continues, but when will we wage our war against poverty? Who will fight for all the men and women and children who were starving and homeless before the attacks and those who will come after? Who will ensure that their basic needs are met? Will war do this for us? Research published in The State of the World showed that less than 1% of what the world spent every year on weapons was needed to put every child into school in the year 2000, and yet it didn't happen. Not only could we feed every child in the United States, but we could give them the education they're entitled to as well. The issue isn't that there isn't enough food or resources. The issue is that our system is set up so that not everyone has access to all that our country has to offer. However, the September 11th attack showed us that it is possible to unite and that working together we can accomplish great things. Let us imagine a world without poverty, a world without war. Let us create our own vision of a society that suits the needs of our children, a world where all the richness is shared by all of us and not lost in war or controlled by a handful of billionaires. That's it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society where the same tools of electronics and computerization that are being used to displace millions of workers worldwide are used for the benefit of the planet as a whole. If you'd like more information about the League or our other print or audio publications, you can contact us by calling 1-800-691-6888, 1-800-691-6888, or visit us on the internet at www.lrna.org. My name is Mike Thornton, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.